This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. After a two-year investigation into the use and abuse of personal information and political influence by Cambridge Analytica, the UK Information Commissioner, Elizabeth Denham, published her conclusions in October in a letter to the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, Elizabeth Denham gives her first in-depth interview following the end of the ICO investigation, discussing its findings and what comes next. I'll also be reuniting three former witnesses to the 2018-19 DCMS Select Committee inquiry into disinformation and fake news, which also played a key role in investigating Cambridge Analytica. These are Emma Bryant, David Carroll, and Chris Vickery. Elizabeth Denham, it's wonderful to have you with us on the Infotagen podcast. It seems now like such a long time ago since one of the first times we spoke, which wasn't directly, which was actually on a broadcast of Channel 4 News, where we heard live on air that Facebook had sent people into Cambridge Analytica's offices, just as the Cambridge Analytica story started, really. The scandal had broken. And you had to take action to try and get those Facebook people out of that building and to take control of the situation yourself. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how this investigation started for the Information Commission and a bit about that particular day itself.
I remember that day so well, Damien. Pleased to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation. But I think Cambridge Analytica has become, I guess, a sort of a shorthand for misdeeds and misuse of data in recent times, especially in the context of elections. But the ICO started its work in a different way. We weren't in enforcement mode at the beginning. We were trying to look at the entire ecosystem of the use of data in political campaigning. So that meant political parties, data brokers, credit reporting agencies, data analytic companies, and campaigning services like Cambridge Analytica. So what we wanted to do was pull back the curtain so that the public could understand how their personal data was used. And that was the beginning of our work. So we were well into that work that day that I appeared on Channel 4 News.
And I mean, there was an initial problem that you had, which I think has been addressed in a reform of your powers, about getting the warrant you needed to seize the assets of Cambridge Analytica for your data investigation. But also, what sort of discussion did you have with Facebook about the fact that to the outside world, it looked like Facebook were trying to get in first before anyone else could?
Yeah, well, I learned about Facebook being in the offices of Cambridge Analytica while I was sitting being interviewed by Jon Snow. And we had been trying to get a warrant for several days using an antiquated process in the former law. And I'll tell you, that's a story that I'm going to tell my grandchildren, because when we finally got the warrant at the end of 3 days and two different judges, I felt like I was in a Hogwarts episode going down the dark halls of the courthouse looking for a seal for the warrant. And we served the warrant on Cambridge Analytica at 11 o'clock at night. When we heard that the Facebook was going in on its own to audit Cambridge Analytica, we had to act very quickly to get their tanks off our lawn. And it was inappropriate for Facebook that because they were involved in the misuse of data for them to be auditing before a public authority got in there.
I think that's right. I think that was one of the most concerning things at the start of this process, that given the whole central question around the Cambridge Analytica story was this ability of Cambridge Analytica to acquire Facebook user data in a massive data breach, that this should be investigated by the proper authorities and not by Facebook itself, where we may have known very little about it. I mean, from your investigation, what sense did you get from the extent to which Facebook was aware that there was a problem at Cambridge Analytica?
When we went through the data and the data at Cambridge Analytica servers and also information in submissions that we'd received from Facebook, we knew that they were aware of problems at Cambridge Analytica and the the acquisition of data from the personality app. They were aware of that in 2014, 2015. So they were definitely part of what we were looking at in our investigation. And again, inappropriate for Facebook to be doing its own audit of Cambridge Analytica. But our lawyers spoke to Facebook lawyers and they were soon out of the building. But again, it took us another day to serve the warrant on Cambridge Analytica and seize the servers. And thank goodness the law has been reformed so that we have a more streamlined urgent assessment power in our law.
For me, there were two big issues as obviously the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee inquiry started to look at Cambridge Analytica. And that about this whole story. And for me, there were really sort of two, I think, boiled down to two big questions. One was about what were Cambridge Analytica doing, which is a big, big sort of piece of work in its own right. The second was, what can Facebook do with data and how much data does Facebook acquire? And I think they're both really important questions. And I'd like to discuss those further. But before we do, I think there was a bit of a reaction from the letter that you sent to the current DCMS Select Committee, which really brought to an end the investigation and the work the ICO had done looking at Cambridge Analytica. And I think some people interpreted that as being a sense of, well, in the end, there was nothing to see here. And in the end, nothing was really done. But that's not the case at all, is it? Because I think you were very clear of the action you did take within the powers you had against Cambridge Analytica and Facebook.
Yes, power and using our previous powers to issue sanctions against many companies, including data brokers. But one of the things that I'm really conscious of as a regulator is that we don't get to write the headlines. And we can spend months working with the sector, an entire sector, to improve compliance with the law, and it will go unreported. We can issue, let's say, a multi-million pound fine to prompt better compliance in one company, and it's going to be covered by every national newspaper. And that's the reality, Damon. That's the nature of the work we do. But the same is true around this investigation. The letter that I sent to the current Select Committee was the latest update of the work that's been going on, as you say, for a considerable amount of time. And it references all of the action that we've taken, including sanctions against Cambridge Analytica. That's been disrupted. It's not operating anymore. Alexander Nix has been struck and is unable to act as a director of any company. But the headlines following our letter, focusing particularly on our finding that Cambridge Analytica did not use GSR data in relation to campaigning in the Brexit referendum, that's what our investigation found. We found that they were playing fast and loose with personal data, including the use of that data in the US campaign. But as a regulator, I have to be clear where we find wrongdoing and where we don't. So what I think is the headline in that letter, it should be what the investigation achieved, the penalties that we issued, and the behavior we've seen changed. And that's the real legacy of our work. That's the ecosystem legacy of our work. It's not just about one company.
I think that's very important. And I think if we break down what this Cambridge Analytica story was about, which is that Dr. Alexander Kogan, working at Cambridge University, created an app which is a personality quiz that acquired Facebook user data, not just for people that took part in the quiz, but all of their contacts as well, as Facebook policies at that time let you do. And that harvested about 87 million data profiles from Facebook. And from that, from your investigation, it seems that Cambridge Analytica created a working set of about 30 million profiles, which it used for the benefit of targeting voters in American elections, in state-by-state elections, using Facebook's ad tools like lookalike audiences, which once you've got a group of profiles of one set of people, it helps you find other people who are like them. So they did psychological profiling based on scraped Facebook data targeting American voters. And there was also, I think, data of about a million people from the UK captured in this as well. Did you find any evidence of whether that data was used, or do you think Cambridge Analytica's interest was solely in acquiring data on American voters?
what we found from analyzing the communications and the emails in their servers, what we actually found there was that the modeling that they were interested in doing and the use of the data was directed towards the US side. But again, remembering that this investigation was about what Facebook did, which was illegal, it wasn't monitoring its own terms of use, and failed to safeguard the data of the 80 million plus users of the personality app and their friends around the world. So our maximum fine at the time was £500,000. We issued that to Facebook. I think Facebook has improved the monitoring of its platform since then. But again, the broader story is about the trade in personal data. It's about what the platforms do with data. It's about what data brokers are selling to political campaigns and political parties. That's why the work that we've done has taken 3 years to do. And you would have seen, Damien, that we most recently completed an audit of seven main political parties in the UK. Because again, what we're up against is fast-changing technology, a huge thirst for more data, more services to micro-target people, and we want to make sure that elections are fair and that they're transparent and that people understand how their digital footprints can be used.
Because this has really become, I think, a bit of a digital Wild West, or certainly in America, that people can be targeted based on psychological profiles. We've seen from Charles Creel's recent film, which Chris Vickery is in as well, People You May Know, that you know, data about people's personal problems and sensibilities and sensitivities that were gathered by American churches were used to target people in elections. And I know that when I was chairman of the Select Committee and you appeared in front of us on many occasions, that you said that you really thought under European law that gathering data and using it in that way to target people in political campaigns is already a breach of data protection law.
It's already a breach of data protection law in the UK and in Europe, but in the US, and I'm sure many of your commentators have said on this program, in US law, in fact, it's acceptable. And I think even with the strengthening of laws that we see in states like California, that's a consumer privacy law and it doesn't cover political parties. So the strength of laws that do cover all agencies using personal data, it's important that regulators have oversight of this. And David Carroll, for example, had to use the British law to get access, to request access to data about himself held by Cambridge Analytica, but he wouldn't have that right in the US. So it's really important that liberal democracies create the kind of oversight that we need, because the train is leaving the station when it comes to psychometric analysis and more sophisticated use of data analytics. And that's why it's so important that investigative journalists, academics, technologists, and regulators, parliamentarians are looking at this issue, because it's truly an international issue, and data of this type and these kinds of processes and techniques know no borders.
Absolutely. One of the questions that I think persisted around Cambridge Analytica was there a connection to Russia? Now, since the investigation that the Select Committee did, and indeed subsequent to the work that the ICO have done as well, we've now been told by papers unsealed from the Mueller investigation in America that Cambridge Analytica polling data and research data, along with other research data, was given by Paul Manafort to consultants working in the Ukraine, one of whom has now been exposed by the US Senate Intelligence Committee as being a Russian spy. There was something, a question that we discussed in front of the committee as well, which was whether other people had access to Cambridge Analytica data from the data servers where it was stored and the cloud storage systems where it was stored. And your investigation identified that there were IP addresses in Russia that were seeking access to that data. And I believe you passed that information on to the National Crime Agency and other law enforcement agencies. I just wondered if there was any more you could tell us about that.
Well, we confirmed in looking at the data on the Cambridge Analytica servers that CA had a lot of international links. And I did speak with you in the committee about links to Russia. And what we did was indeed we passed on what we saw from the investigation to the National Crime Agency, because this matter falls outside of the remit of the ICO. And we didn't find any additional evidence of Russian involvement in the second analysis of the material. We shouldn't be surprised about international links, though, because that goes back to my other point, that this issue and these problems are truly international in scope.
Mm. And of course, Alexander Kogan, who had obviously acquired a lot of this data for Cambridge Analytica, he was at around that time also working on a study looking at cyberbullying that was being funded by the Russian government at the University of St. Petersburg. So there was a Russian link, but Cambridge Analytica and Alexander Nix always said that they'd never done work in Russia. So I suppose it leaves a question hanging as to why someone from Russia was seeking access to that data.
Yeah, and again, I don't know the answer to that. Not our direct remit. We did what we could in passing on the information, but I think one of the themes, Damien, that really came through in this investigation was how international the data is. And we saw evidence on the servers that Cambridge Analytica was looking to move its services to a jurisdiction where it could actually be outside of any kind of scrutiny of a regulator. And I think that's another reason why parliamentarians around the world, jurisdictions around the world, need to look at this problem internationally. Liberal democracies have to have strong electoral laws, they have to have strong data protection laws, strong cybersecurity. And we've seen the conversations going on around the world and the strengthening of laws. So that's another really important outcome of this investigation.
Absolutely. I'd like to come on to talk about that in a moment, but just to step back to something you've just said about Cambridge Analytica, because I mean, your investigation disrupted the company in effect, and the company was subsequently wound up. But that's quite interesting that you've discovered that Cambridge Analytica were looking to potentially move their data processing to a new jurisdiction. Were you able to discover where they were seeking to move it to?
We saw that we don't know what happened at the end of the day, but the thinking was to move to the Caribbean at the point of 2017 when we started to look very closely at Cambridge Analytica.
So that would have enabled them presumably to process data from people from all around the world in a jurisdiction where there may not have been much in the way of data protection law that the citizens could appeal to.
Exactly right. And so as long as they stayed in a jurisdiction such as the UK with a data protection law that covers not just the data of citizens in that country, but the practices of the company. So for us, we didn't have to look at whether or not it was only UK citizens that were being that were targeted or that their data was being processed. We have the ability under our law and we have the jurisdiction to look at whether or not the company itself operating in the UK is doing so in compliant with the law.
We had in a previous episode of the Infotagen podcast, a fellow Canadian, Jim Balsillie, talking to us, and he said that he thought there should be a kind of Bretton Woods, a sort of international conference and agreement on tech policy. We're seeing tech and data, digital policy forming an increasingly significant part of international trade agreements now as well. I mean, do you think there needs to be a coming together of leading Western governments around the world to try and create some rules and standards? Whilst we may have a different approach to some of these issues, there should be some common standards in terms of supporting information commissioners accessing data for their investigations and giving some basic minimum rights to people around the world.
Absolutely. And I think the initial discussions that took place under your leadership of the DCS Select Committee, the bringing together the Grand Committee of parliamentarians around the world to discuss this problem, that was a very good first step. But I think some international fora such as the G7 and the G20, organizations like the Council of Europe have to get together on these issues, because otherwise, if we don't agree to minimum standards, then you will see the bad actors just moving to jurisdictions where there's less scrutiny.
And I mean, for the ICO in the UK, I mean, do you feel that given the size of the task at hand, that you have the resources you need to pursue the investigations you'd like to?
The law has been modernized. So, you know, we don't have to wait days and days before we can get a warrant. We have powers that I think are more befitting a digital regulator that make us fit for purpose. Do we have enough resources? No regulator is going to ever say that they have enough resources. We have more, Damien. We have twice the staff that we had in 2016. But I think what's really important in the UK is that because of this investigation and because of our joint work with the Electoral Commission, with the securities agencies, cyber security agencies, we are now monitoring elections in a way that we haven't in the past. So I think the coming together of the patchwork of regulators that have remits in this arena is really important. And I also think that us taking on this investigation, which challenged us because of the forensic skills that we had to bring to the table, because of the legal skills that we had to bring to the table, because of the type of digital analysis that we needed to do, have made us a much stronger fit for purpose regulator. And I think other data protection regulators around the world, those that have jurisdiction over the use of data in political campaigns, have taken note.
Now, just going back to the previous investigation, I mean, I remember when you were in front of the Select Committee, we discussed the work you'd done looking at Aaron Banks's company, Eldon Insurance, and leave.eu. And indeed, I mean, you fined leave.eu for data offences, and you flagged up concerns that Eldon Insurance data had been mixed in with leave.eu data when it was being processed, which was against the rules. Are there still things you're looking to investigate around those issues, or is that now concluded?
That's not a concluded matter. We are facing an appeal, the second round of court appeal on the Eldon Insurance leave.eu audit. So after two rounds of an appeal, we're facing the challenge to getting our investigators in to look at Eldon Insurance. January 2021 is when the hearing is.
So there could still be a further if you're successful. Well, if you're successful in that hearing, then there would still be a further audit of that data to be done.
That is correct.
And just before we sort of widen the discussion and bring in our other guests, who I'll introduce in a moment, looking at the election in America, some people have said, well, what's really changed since 2016? I think, in my view, firstly, there's a lot more scrutiny of these issues, which weren't really discussed at all at that time. And I think that's a consequence of the investigations that have been done. There have been some new tools the companies have launched, and in Facebook in particular, it's their ad library and the requirement that you have to try and prove who you are before you can set up the Facebook page that runs political ads. But I think the ad library seemed to be flawed, and indeed in the UK general election in 2019, the ad library even went down for a period of time. I mean, do you think these tools are effective, or do you think it's still quite easy for people to game the system and run ads without really revealing who they are and who's paying for them?
I've been disappointed in the ad libraries. I mean, they do bring some transparency in political campaigning. Transparency is always a positive step, but they're not enough. They're only one side of the coin. So they show the message, but not how the message was targeted, who saw it, and why was that audience selected. So I don't think they work from that perspective. But I do agree Damien, that the investigations that have been carried out, the parliamentary hearings, the work by academics and investigative reporters have really changed behaviors. And I think it's changed the behaviors of organizations who saw the increased regulatory focus on the use of data, the fines that were given to Facebook, seeing the end of Cambridge Analytica. And I think what's happened as a result of that is that these organizations are taking data protection seriously. And I think it's changed the behaviors of political parties who've been given a much clearer picture of what the law is required of them. And in the UK, our audits of the seven main political parties is helping there. I hope, though, that it's also changed the behavior of people, because, I mean, that was the starting point of our work on the use of data in political campaigns. We really wanted to pull back the curtain so that people could understand the kind of behavioral targeting that they were getting used to for shopping for holidays and trainers was now being used to micro-target them in political campaigns. And I hope that people realize the importance of reducing their digital footprints and paying attention to the kind of ads and messages that they receive. They need to be curious. They need to challenge them. So I'm very much hoping that this work is easy to speak to people about, because that's what's going to make the biggest change.
Indeed, and actually, it makes me think, as you say that, we have political parties, which are, you know, which their leadership and their policies change, but they're continuous entities. But we've also seen the emergence of short-lived campaigns and short-lived campaigning organisations, which come and go. Thinking in particular of the Brexit Party, Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, they would have gathered a lot of data during the European elections last year and in other subsequent campaigning about UK voters. They're now saying they're going to change the focus of that organisation, change its name to Reform UK and make it a campaigning body campaigning against COVID lockdowns and things like that. Would data gathered for a Brexit Party campaign on really focus on the EU, would they have the right to use that data for a new political organisation? Would they need the permission of those users to do so?
A simple change of name for a party that was consistent in its policy objectives wouldn't be against the law to make use of that data. But if the party is changing its policy, if the party is changing its focus, then the use of that data would not be allowed under data protection law, not without the consent of the individuals involved.
And actually, before we finish, I have one question that comes up a lot. I know you've always been very clear on it, but I think it'd be great to get it on the podcast. Is when you talk about consent, we're all very familiar with these very long terms and conditions forms that people check to say that they've read them and no one ever reads them. That's not good enough, is it, in terms of people giving their consent? They have to know or be informed properly what they're signing up to.
The GDPR changed what's required of consent, and consent has to be clear. It has to be informed, and people have to have a real choice to be able to revoke their consent. So those long terms and conditions, which end with, and you agree to give up your firstborn to X, Y, and Z, those are not compliant consent forms. And it's a long and tireless journey to try to get companies to use real informed consent. But you will have seen, Damien, that we've taken some action around consent and the absence of consent, especially in the credit reporting context.
Absolutely. And finally, we've been speaking the last few editions of the podcast about the impact that President-elect Joe Biden may have on digital policy. What's your sense of the direction the new administration will go in?
Well, the direction of travel, I think Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are alive to the challenges of digital regulation. I think they want to see the end of the Wild West in the use of data. And I think states like California and Maine and Washington are all looking seriously at changing and improving, or have done so, their consumer privacy laws. So I don't think it's out of the question that we will see a federal privacy law in the U.S. in the coming years. And that's certainly the hope that many in my field have. And it seems the time has come for a federal law in the U.S.
Elizabeth Denham, thank you so much for joining us for that part of the podcast. It's been great to talk about these issues with you.
Thank you very much, Damien. Delighted.
So it's been great to discuss those issues with Elizabeth Denham. But as we really look back over the Cambridge Analytica investigation, I wanted to widen the discussion with people that were intimately involved with it, all of whom have been people that gave evidence to the Select Committee investigation as well. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Chris Vickery, David Carroll, and Emma Bryant. David, if I could start with you in a way, because it was your request for your data from Cambridge Analytica made to the Information Commissioner, a story that was central to the film The Great Hack, that played quite a big part in this investigation. Looking back at where we are now, you've subsequently got hold of your data thanks to a Channel 4 investigation. Do you feel that the questions you set out to answer have been answered by this investigation?
Thanks, Damien. It's great to be back and to reflect on this after the 2020 election in particular. But yes, just before the 2020 election, Channel 4 News showed up at my door and gave me the data that I had expected to be trying to get the whole time and what I had hoped the Information Commissioner's Office would be able to deliver. And it was the data that was described. It was voter data that had been blended with data broker data. It was much more detailed than the data that was provided to me in March of 2017. And it did include psychometric scoring and profiling, things that the company denied it had collected. So in terms of the basic questions that we asked as a function of the complaint and the legal claim, not all the questions were ever answered, even though the ICO demanded that the questions be answered and the administrators pled guilty to the offense of ignoring that enforcement notice to answer the questions. So some questions do still remain, but we have gotten answers in different ways. And I think it is important that we did achieve some success, although it was troubling that we were achieving new revelations mere days before the next election. So perhaps the pace of these investigations doesn't happen quickly enough to then prepare for the next cycle.
And I mean, Emma, a lot of your academic research was focused on propaganda techniques, methods of disseminating political information, including disinformation. And I suppose looking where we are now, whilst there's still a lot more to investigate, I think that there's a much higher general awareness of these issues, and in particular, the key role that data plays. I remember from my role in the Select Committee investigation, I think we began to see quite quickly that this was not just an investigation about bad content, but the data that drives that content too.
Yes, absolutely. And how it's being processed, not just by the platforms, but by all these influence firms who are processing it for elections and other purposes. So one of the things I want to say here is actually just it's got a lot more to do with the things we can't anticipate. than it does just about our own individual consent. One of the things that I think is really important to highlight is that, you know, while we're trying, you know, to work towards a point where people can give, you know, meaningful informed consent, actually data is most powerful in the aggregate, in, you know, for social purposes that we can't necessarily always anticipate. And it's processed in ways that, you know, the ordinary citizen is never, ever going to be able to fully understand and comprehend. And a lot of experts struggle to comprehend. So I think this is something that means that, you know, while a lot of us are becoming more aware, that there is a massive limitation to what we can really understand about this. And I think that isn't really quite appreciated in a lot of the public debates about it. You know, a result of a lot of this is actually, yes, people are becoming more aware, but are they actually changing their behaviors? I don't think they really are. I think what's really happening is people are becoming desensitized to their data being used in these ways, especially in the United States. I think a lot of people tend to feel that, oh, well, my data is being used this way. I can't do anything about it. So I'll try not to think about it. And unfortunately, you know, I think there hasn't necessarily always been the political will, especially not in the United States, to do anything. I hope Elizabeth Denham is right about the Biden administration. I certainly think we have an uphill struggle still to go on this.
And Chris, I mean, your work has been so important to the work that so many of us have done. I mean, I remember that day when you gave evidence to the Select Committee in Westminster, where you brought this file, this database you discovered, this very large data store that really, I think really sort of brought home just how much data is gathered, how many different data sets from all sorts of different backgrounds, including the use of data from churches, which was extraordinary. And I think it shows the scale and ambition of what's been going on, and probably that was well beyond what many people would have realized at that time. And it'd be very interesting if you could comment on that for the podcast, and also a sense of, you know, do you think this is continuing to get worse? Is this problem accelerating?
Well, that's an interesting thing to mention here. And I believe this is the first time that the public has learned that in our closed session that was after the public thing where I was speaking, what you just mentioned was something I delved into, and that is the church side of things, at least in the US, that's feeding into this. If people remember the diagram that I provided to you originally, the public one had a purple hash mark and a censored area that was visible in the private discussion that we had off, you know, that was not being broadcast publicly. Yeah. And behind that redacted section was my note of, I'm pretty darn sure, or was at that time, that there is a big connection to data being siphoned off and added into this from very far fundamental, baseline, kind of concerning level Christian churches in the US. And that turned out to be very, very correct, and was the subject of Charles's recent documentary, People You May Know.
And I mean, I've watched the film and discussed this with Charles on the podcast as well. It's quite chilling to when you think about the fact that data gathered by churches, about often people who are quite vulnerable at quite vulnerable stages of their lives, could be used to create a psychological profile of them that could then be used to target them with messages in an election. I mean, that is pretty chilling stuff.
It was even more chilling and pernicious than that. What United in Purpose did, and Bill Dallas is on camera discussing this, they went to the mega churches in the US, they talked to the pastors, the priests, whoever was in charge there, convinced them to provide the congregation database that the church had, lists of, you know, the people that attend church and donate money to the church, and then use that to compare against voter registration rolls that they had gotten, I personally believe, from the GOP Data Trust, and figure out who's not registered to vote, who is registered to vote, and then select a champion within that congregation to approach the people that are not registered to vote and get them to register. The important part of the champion thing is that's somebody in the congregation that knows these people, that knows who's going to vote for their side and understands who can be convinced and persuaded and can be very selective in getting the right kind of people to then be registered to vote.
There's analysis been done of the 2020 election. We had on recently on the podcast Laura Edelson from New York University, who's they're crowdsourcing ads that people receive to see how they're being targeted. And she told us that, again, there's evidence there of psychological profiling in how people are being targeted, certainly not being targeted based on their known political views. I mean, do you think this is, do you think this is basically a lawless area where people will gather whatever data they can use to improve their targeting and they'll exploit it if they can?
Well, it's being treated as a lawless area. It's not a lawless area because what they're doing is illegal. And here in the US, I can say very plainly, it's criminal. There's crimes being committed widespread. And it's a lack of enforcement that has allowed it. The laws to stop this crime exist. They're on the books. We just need regulators, law enforcement, leaders that understand how this is a crime and have the wherewithal to go through and enforce the correct punishments.
And I think that's right. I think we've, as you say, in a lot of cases, the offences are already, the law's already there for the offences, but it requires the investigations to uncover the offence and then to take enforcement action. I mean, to all three of you, I'd be just interested in your views on where we are now, more than 2 years on since the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke in March 2018, 18 months on since the interim Select Committee report was published, and there have been multiple other investigations around the world. I mean, where do you think we are now, and what do you think we need to do next?
So in certain ways, we can thank Alexander Nix and Steve Bannon and all the other affiliates for committing their mischief in the early days and culminating in the scandal of 2018, because it created a crisis that then activated the political will to reform and wake up to this problem. So the investigations around the world, the passage of the California law, and even a second iteration, a strengthening of the California law in the 2020 ballot measure. And indeed, the scandal Cambridge Analytica, like Elizabeth Denham opened up with, becoming a shorthand for misdeeds, serves as a kind of kryptonite against industry lobbyists who want to water down new legislation and enforcement possibilities. That is sort of, now it will be, remember Cambridge Analytica as the shorthand for what happens when we allow an unregulated industry to prosper and also evade accountability. And so the fact that California will be the first state to have its own data protection authority is a big step forward, and we do owe it to Cambridge Analytica that we have gotten this far, but there's a lot more work to do. And indeed, a national privacy law in the US would go far. The question is, how will it deal with political data? Will politicians limit their own use of this? And how will the difference in the European idea of data protection as a fundamental human right clash with the different American understanding of privacy? That I think is a philosophical thing that I learned about in doing this work myself, in appreciating the philosophical difference, appreciating that data protection is a fundamental human right in the EU Charter, and therefore that explains why the GDPR is so strong compared to what we have and what we need to build. But in order to preserve international data trade and also international data accountabilities, as also what Elizabeth Denham described, the necessity of the US to pass a federal standard to work toward that and achieve that, I think is really important and a key lesson. But we won't know really what happened in 2020 for two reasons. The first reason being, Donald Trump did not win re-election, and so there won't be a post-mortem of how did he win again. But also, we can probably assume that people kept the data in the United States this time, as opposed to in 2016, when the data was exported into a data protecting state like the UK. And so similar to what the ICO letter to the new committee revealed, that the company was actively looking to offshore its data operation to escape accountability. In a certain way, that happened in 2020, that whereas there are no data rights in the US where a US citizen could do what I did in 2016 and figure out what companies did what in 2020. So we're sort of more blind in 2020 than we were in 2016, but at least we are more aware, and as Commissioner Denham described, bad actors have been somewhat deterred.
Emma, you've interviewed a very large number of people that work for Cambridge Analytica and SEL, its sort of parent company, and you heard what Elizabeth said about that she thought that Cambridge Analytica were looking to move to the Caribbean for data processing reasons, to put them outside the jurisdiction of other governments. I mean, what do you think Cambridge Analytica would have done next if they'd been allowed to? And do you think they've really gone away, or does the data and the people exist in new forms?
Definitely not. Of course, they've not gone away. The issue is that these companies basically set up again with a new company and continue very similar work. We have very little transparency over the influence industry and its, you know, complex networks of shell companies. Nothing has changed on that. You also, you know, have very little scrutiny over the last 2 years over the actual companies themselves, rather than the platforms. You know, all the attention went on the platforms, and we didn't discover a lot of the wrongdoing related to the 2016 campaign quickly enough, because actually data was being processed in Cambridge Analytica and other related entities. And, you know, the film that Charles has produced, fantastic film, which I briefed them a little on my work in the beginning stages of that. I've been doing a little bit of work on the churches and the nonprofits involved as well. And, you know, it looks very much like the nonprofits who were doing a lot of this work to gather data with the Cambridge Analytica's help for use, it seems, for not just for digital ministry, but also for potential use in political campaigns. Also, there was racialized modeling going on in the background. For instance, I have evidence that they asked Cambridge Analytica to remove African Americans from the modeling of people's church attendance and moved that, processed that data according to models that would show them people's voting intentions by ethnicity. This is not something that you would normally do for a church. So this kind of stuff was going on before it even hit Facebook. And we need to have some, you know, proper oversight for American citizens of what's going on with their data within these companies that seem to be still black boxes at present.
That's a very, very good point, that last thing about churches and politics. I'm not sure how well Damien's normal audience understands how the American separation of church and state generally works, but churches are not taxed in the U.S. at all, because that's seen as the government trying to, if they were to tax churches, that if they did one thing to one certain religion that did not equally affect all others, such as taxing it, it would be endorsement of the others versus the one that was, you know, punished or made taxed in a certain way. So the idea has been all along that if churches get involved in politics, they lose their tax-exempt status. Mm-hmm. The first part of that has clearly happened. They have, a lot of churches in the U.S. have jumped wholeheartedly into politics and affecting political outcomes, endorsing candidates, providing data and funding and support. But they, for some strange reason, have not lost their tax-exempt status. And that could be a very powerful tool in convincing them to back off and stop doing this, start taxing them.
Yeah, there's a very basic breakdown of trust here. There is absolutely, you know, no way that people know what's being done with their data behind the scenes here. And, you know, these companies are using categories which seem very, very disturbing, like targeting neurotics with fear-driven messaging that, you know, during, for instance, you know, some of the most stressful times, you know, of our lives during this pandemic, this would be really, really problematic if you have this kind of data being used for politics. We've seen, you know, QAnon conspiracy theories going around the internet and all sorts of attacks on the legitimacy of elections. And we have absolutely no way of knowing whether mental health or other kinds of data that are protected about very, very vulnerable people might be being used.
But I think there's a really important point in that as well, Emma, that there's the discussion we're having about where this data comes from, how it's acquired, and as Elizabeth Denham said, that, you know, the to use this sort of data acquired in this way in a political campaign, certainly in the UK, would be illegal. But there's also the question of the fact that this data becomes powerful when you can use it on a social media platform like Facebook, which groups people together, which helps you find more people who are of a similar disposition or have a similar interest or have a similar problem. And that's surely something that I think needs to come within the scope of the UK government's proposed online harms legislation, because if you can target someone based on their psychological weaknesses, based on data you've gathered about them, you shouldn't really be able to exploit that on Facebook to drive harmful messages at people.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing, is they're producing these lists behind the scenes of people gathered through these very, you know, sensitive kind of data that they have and they're holding. And then they're uploading it, of course, to Facebook. And Facebook are trying to find lookalike audiences or whatever. You know, this is not acceptable. We can't be doing this kind of, you should not be able to micro-target your own lists of people that you have gathered in these kinds of really problematic ways. Facebook has no way of knowing how that data has been gathered. So we need both, you know, Facebook to be, you know, properly, you know, overseeing its own tools, but also, you know, the wider industry of how data is being used for politics, but not just for politics, for all sorts of purposes, which may well be coming to play in our elections as well. So churches are not traditionally part of politics, but it's about data use more broadly.
Yeah. And I think it shows that when we talk about wanting to see more regulation in the space, what we're really talking about is not regulating speech as such, but regulating a business model, which has made these things possible.
And regulating disclosure, which I think enforcing disclosure is something that will survive First Amendment challenges in the US. And because, of course, the FEC, Federal Elections Commission, requires the disclosure of identities and payments in certain situations. And there was a moment in the Channel 4 news broadcast, it's a recent one, where it showed voters their own data files in competitive districts in Wisconsin. And I thought that there were key moments in that coverage that exemplified how people being able to see their own data related to elections neutralizes the damaging or harmful effect in a certain way, that it recalibrates the asymmetry of knowledge. And there was one African-American voter who was shown her voter profile and she was shown that she was marked by the Trump campaign for deterrence. And she was asked by Krishna and Gurumurthy about how she felt about being marked for deterrence. And when, you know, her main response was that it made her want to vote even more in the next election. And that, you know, the intent of deterrence when it was revealed had the opposite effect. And ultimately the data can be used to mobilize and demobilize. The data itself is not necessarily harmful. It's how it's used and for what purposes. And then is there transparency and deception around that use? And I thought that was a critical example of how in the US, we really just need the basic fundamental right of access and what a disproportionately positive effect that could have at deterring bad behavior. If people can see these segmentations, they can see how the campaigns are identifying and labeling them, it could, just on that alone, prevent some bad behavior that we see being used rampantly. And I thought that was a key moment in the recent coverage and really spoke to how the concerns about where our data goes are paramount. And it was also remarkable in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence is Russia report, where it documented its probe of Cambridge Analytica SCL. It noted that there were members of the campaign, in particular Rick Gates, who was one of Paul Manafort's key players, that even he was concerned that US voter data was being transferred to Cambridge Analytica SCL in the UK. So even he shared the same concern that I had very long ago. Why is our data leaving our country? What is going on there? And why is the company not being honest with even its own client, the campaign? So that was a key moment in that report that I think vindicated what Elizabeth Denham was also saying, is that the necessity for international cooperation is central because the data respects no boundaries and campaigns have been known now to internationalize their operations.
Absolutely.
I was going to say real fast, that brings up a very good thing to clarify. I think it's being misrepresented that data is moved. Data doesn't move. It is copied. It's still in the original location. It's just another copy exists in another location. And if we can clarify that narrative for regulators around the world, that this is not a physical good that is being shipped away. Data is sticky. Data exists. It's not going away. When somebody says it's moved to the UK or moved to Ireland or whatever, it's not being moved. It's just being copied and given to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Emma.
I just wanted to say about the bringing it back to the international element of this, which Elizabeth Denham raised, which I think is extremely important. The fact that, you know, Cambridge Analytica were going to move their operations overseas for data storage or copy or whatever. But the issue is that, you know, companies do this all the time. And I've been told on several occasions by other companies that, you know, they might be working with foreign partners in order to get things done because it's in a different jurisdiction and they don't necessarily have to abide by, you know, the laws of countries like the United States, which has, you know, more stricter lobbying laws and things like this. So this kind of international jurisdiction differences gets utilized all the time for navigating legal boundaries. And we really need to think this through. I think the Bretton Woods suggestion is a good one, but we need to be thinking about the rules of the game when it comes to influence operations as well that go beyond this. And thinking about some kind of sort of Geneva Convention when it comes to influence and campaigns internationally, and making sure that no country is a harbor for data misuse. We also, though, if we have, you know, international governments coming together in some kind of UN to discuss how this is regulated internationally, We also need to be making sure that that isn't becoming a backdoor for governments to gain access to our data. So we need to have some kind of thought going into how this exists as an independent entity. And I hope there'll be more discussions around international regulation that protects not just us, but also, you know, parts of the developing world where data rights are exploited by local and especially, you know, big corporate firms based in places like the UK.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it, as we bring this discussion to a close, I think it puts a good focus on what we need to do in the future, which is that there needs to be greater cooperation to make it harder for people to effectively offshore data processing so they can do things outside of jurisdictions of their own country. But also, I think as data becomes a more important part of government policy and the delivery of public services, that we live in a world where people are increasingly concerned about how their data is gathered and used, and they need to be able to trust that process if they're going to support it. But I'm afraid we'll have to, I think, bring the podcast to an end at this point. But it's been a fascinating discussion. Emma, Chris and David, thank you for joining us for this bit of the podcast. It's been great to be with you again to talk about these important issues.
Thank you, Damien.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Damien.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Elizabeth Denham, Emma Bryant, David Carroll and Chris Vickery. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagemPodcast. Infotagem is a not-for-profit organisation, and all proceeds will go towards the making of this podcast. Thank you until next time.